Lori.
Good morning. Buenos días. Bokor tov. Nobody respond. Ndemana darachu. That's my language. Akambute. So, anyway, it's very hard to follow a very nice presentation by Rani. So please forgive me. My presentation will not be the same like mine. Okay? My topic is just to talk about use of community assessment for public health emergency response, CASPERS. This is not the ghost, that the cartoon character. Okay, it's a little bit different. And it's not the last name. One of my colleagues is Annie Casper. Her name is here. So a lot of confusion. Basically, CASPERS probably came across in another literature that's rapid need assessment, RNE. Just to differentiate, we started to call it CASPER. So this is a review we did just in the last few years. As you know, the public health role of preparedness for any responding to emergency has expanded in the face of major impacts from recent disaster. Disaster defined just a classic definition, just to say serious disruption of functioning of the society, causing widespread human, material, and environmental issue. So disaster can be classified in three major groups. That is natural disaster, human induced. We try to be away from man-made. Okay, we say human. To be fair, okay, not only man who make a disaster. So women can make also disaster. So let's say human induced disaster. Then complex emergency or complex disaster. That's the first group we can talk about. The number of disasters, both natural and human-induced disaster, increased from 2003 to 2012. Just in the U.S., there were around 1,395 presidentially declared disaster reported. Just in 2012, FEMA declared for 7 major disasters, 291 deaths, and 90 billion property damage. Just, you know, there is a limitation on the number of days to talk about, but this is roughly, maybe it is not an accurate. We suspect most of the time there's under report on the days. The public health implication of disaster are multiple. Just, it can be environmental hazard, or it can be contamination of food and water, or it can be displaced population, overcrowding in the shelters, which Miguel was talking about, and the damage to the health department, hospitals, and the clinics. As this is a major things we expect during any disaster. The application of epidemiology, the disaster setting, also known as a disaster epidemiology, can provide the accurate information for use for policymakers, planners, or incident commanders, and the decision makers. The main objective of disaster epidemiologies are to prevent or reduce the number of deaths or illnesses and injury, or provide timely and accurate health information, and improve prevention and mitigation strategy for the future. Okay, yes, we need to try to match the demand and the supply during a disaster. That's where we lie the relative concept of disaster. I would say disaster epidemiology, there are three major groups they can focus, which one is the surveillance. When you say surveillance, we talk about specifically disaster-related morbidity and mortality. We are not trying to replace any surveillance system during this category, just focus on morbidity and mortality, disaster-related things. Tracking and the research, just some issues coming. Rene was talking about how to follow the responders. And from the population side, also we need to think whether we need to do a track for the community. The third category is assessment. One part is the environmental assessment, where Miguel was talking about this morning, about shelter assessment. But the third component is community, that's community assessment for public health emergency response, or CASPER, which focuses on the community other than other parts of the world. So I will focus only on the community assessment topics. What is CASPER? CASPER, as I said, is an epidemiological technique designed to provide quickly in there as locals. It is household-based information about the community as needs in simple format for decision makers. The goal of CASPERS are to rapidly obtain, information about the needs of the community, produce population-based or household-based estimates for decision-makers. We go to sample some area, we generalize that finding to the affected area. To assess new or changes needs during the recovery period. This is kind of a follow-up disaster we advocate for. So the history of the CASPER, when it comes, just this is not new. The methodology was developed long ago, in the early 70s. So by WHO expanded program on immunization EPI survey technique for estimating vaccine coverage, especially for less resources countries. That was initially that methodology was designed for non-disaster. Okay, that was the immunization program started. And the 80 US Academy scientists identified the fastest technique, and then the early 90 WHO published the protocol for best practice. In the early 1996, the modified cluster sampling methodology, which was done by Josephine Madulai, she is on ADS and our branch, for the first time was used for disaster response. So the CASPER background in CDC side, I can say just in 2009, CDC developed the CASPER toolkit, which is online, and it is updated in year 2012. And the collected information. We have in 2010, CDC created a CASPER metadatabase, kind of tracking the CASPER which was conducted in state. Collected information on geographic location, type of events, objectives, and methodology used, significant findings, and the intervention feedback recommendation provided. We were tracking all this information, creating a metadatabase for that. In 2012, CDC, we reviewed the CASPER methodology. Our objective on reviewing this study was to identify, is there any significant finding or in general overall review, and recognize, is there any strengths of the CASPER methodology, what are the weakness, what are the lessons learned from these topics, and the key concepts from previously conducted CASPERs. And we try to explore ways CASPER can be used for future activity, and summarize the use of CASPER in the last 10 years. The method, what we did with the metadatabase for CASPER conducted during these 10 years, a decade, were compared descriptively for difference in geographical distribution, and sampling methodology, as I said, mapping tools used, assessment events, type of disaster, assessment timing, action decision makers, taken by decision makers, recommendation and the publication. We used just a regular Microsoft Excel and ArcGIS for mapping. Our findings just in the last 10 years, from 2010 to 2012, there were 53 CASPERs were conducted with CDC assistance. We focused only on CASPER conducted with CDC assistance. There are out there different CASPER conducted by state or local territories. So our review is focused only on assistance we provided. CASPER assistance increased from 2 in 2003 to 16 in 2012. CDC personnel were deployed for 52.8% of CASPERs and provided remote technical assistance for other 47.1%. When I say remote technical assistance, it can be assisting and sampling methodology, mapping, questionnaire development, providing guideline on the analysis part, and that is, can be by telephone, webinars, or the different means of communication. And this map, you can see just the you see how the preparedness CASPER starts to increase in the late 2010. After 2010, we see more focus on preparedness part. Before 2010, it was just a response only. There is a gap between 2006 and 2007. By then, the disaster which happened in the United States was very less between 2006 and 2007. So our involvement was not just reviewing what documents we have, but this shows you just how increased, and especially from 2010 to 2012. When you come, this is a geographic distribution of the CASPER. There were 13 states which would assisted in these 10 years, including one territory that was American Samoa. So we traveled, you know, if you remember the 2009 tsunami in American Samoa, so we were engaged twice for that part. Other than that, most of the CASPER, especially Kentucky, was the number one by conducting the CASPER, followed by Texas and then Alabama. And there are other states which conducted. I can say Michigan upstairs, we have done in the North Carolina and Florida, around 7 Caspers were conducted during this time. In sampling methodology, if you see, just almost 90.5% of the assessment conducted a typical recommended two-stage cluster sampling methodology. So that's out of 48 Caspers out of 53. That is two-stage clusters. Out of these two-stage clusters were done by 71%, and the three-stage clusters, 18.8% of the Caspers conducted. Most of the older response Casper in Gulf Coast with its three-stage sampling methodology. There are also other methods Casper conducted, the simple random sampling, systematic or stratified sampling. And also two-stage probability sampling was conducted. Mapping tools, there are two ways in doing this, the global information system and the census web page. And almost 66.1% of the mapping and the sample selection were done by using the GIS. That's cool, a very good resource, especially on sampling. But if you don't have GIS, still you can use a sensor web page to select your clusters to map, use ready-made map, but it's not flexible, but still is usable. When it comes out on the event type, you can see almost 37 were for response, that is related to specific disaster response, around 69.9%. was for that, but 15% was follow-up Caspers, which we recommend to do after a certain period of time to go back to do some assessment. Most of the disasters were as usual, especially in the East Coast, was hurricanes, almost 37%, then followed by oil spill, ice storm, and etc. Wildfire and the tsunami were the least. When it comes to the assessment timing and the action taken by decision makers, almost 37%, as I said, it was disaster related. Two Caspers was conducted less than 3 days. There are 3 to 7 days, around 5.6% of this. And the 14, between 8 days and the 14 days, around 18%. And the 5 months to 2 years, which was 20%, that is kind of longer term follow-up Caspers conducted during that time. Preparedness for non-response is 30.1%. And action by decision makers, yes, documented. Around 47% of this, they documented action taken by decision makers. Unknown, around 52%. So, most common recommendation was just educate the community by both during preparedness and the response. At the end, the recommendation focus on educating the community. And to educate the community, and revise and improve preparedness planning around 7.7%. And to provide services, medication, and debris removal for 3.9%. This is just focused during the response. Okay, and the restore utility need to conduct follow-up Caspers and compare the results with other baseline data. This is part of the recommendation provided. But the first three were the area we focused quite well. Publication status. We distributed a report within 24 to 48 hours after collecting the data. We were able to generate the report and provide to the state members. But the publication, it takes time. So almost 51% of the report was published in peer-reviewed journal or MMWR. That's a good opportunity to share your finding with other part of the world. The limitation from this study is we focused only on Casper conducted with CDC assistance. This doesn't mean that there is no any Casper conducted by state or local authorities. There are out there some, especially in Kentucky and Tennessee, nowadays in West Coast, California, they are doing by their own because we train them, we provide them the available resources, they are doing by their own. That is our goal. CDC, we don't want to come and always then and run the show, come back, and when something happens tomorrow, calling us, I said, we don't want that kind of stuff. So our main aim is to build the local capacity, then the state can take that initiative to do. It's also focused on Casper conducted in United States. It doesn't mean there is no international pursuit. As I said, we focus only on the CDC side. As you know, the disaster epidemiology principle apply everywhere in the world, whether it is in the US or in Africa and somewhere, you apply. But for the study purpose, we focus on this side. You may modify a little bit, you know, sampling and the questionnaires, all this kind of stuff. Other than that, still you 90% of the methodology and the principles will apply whenever you are in any part of the world. In conclusion, the use of CASPERS has greatly increased over the past decade, and the increase in number of CASPERS likely has been influenced by the online release of the CASPERS toolkit, especially in 2009, and the increased number of CASPERS trainings, as I said, where we train the state and provide them resources, and they are taking over that kind of initiative, and increased capacity awareness associated with CDC public health preparedness capacity standards. And the CASPERS are useful tools to support evidence-based public health decision makers during disaster preparedness and the response. That's our conclusion. I would like to acknowledge my co-authors and my co-workers at CDC, and if you have any questions, I will be open. Thank you.
We have time for some specific questions to Tespe before we open it up to the larger discussion. So, anybody have any questions? Yes, please.
I have one question in regards to the time period. You said
actually, 1 second. I forgot something. Could you say your name and where you're from?
Yes.
That way we get to know each other better.
I'm from Texas, Department of State Health Services, Regional Office.
Thank you.
I have a question in regards to the time period. You said
yes, not the disaster event. It is just when you start your CASPER, went down. When is the time you generate the report? So there are very few were able to. Most of the time, the report is generated between 24 to 48 hours. Not the final one. When we provide the report, there are two reports. We give them a preliminary report. Okay, the preliminary report. So what are the major finding, what is the emergency managers I need to know, the emergency operations centers need to do with the community. It's a kind of draft, especially bullet, don't put all this statistical stuff, 90%, 95% confidence interval, deviation, blah, blah, no. Just put what is your major finding and the recommendation you need to do. But the final report, yes, it has to be cleared, all numbers has to be fixed, and all has to be scientific, everything you have to clear. Of course, if you see involved with CDC, you have to get the clearance to share that.
So that was from the time they started actually collecting the surveys to the time they released the initial report?
Yes, because sometimes, you know, that preparedness, it may take time, okay? You may call me, I'm generating the map, it may take me 1 day. You have to pull all your volunteers and you train them. Maybe you need to talk to your logistic. It may take only 1 week. That planning phase, you can't take it. But we consider just, especially for report purpose, you assemble the team, everything is in place, send, you did an interview, come analysis and generate the report. That's the time we are looking for.
Any other questions? Yes, in the back.
Hi, it's Wilson, CDC, Global Science, California Department of Public Health. Chris, California, thank you for being a better disaster. And second, this is really more of a comment than a question, but the CASPER sampling methodology doesn't have to be necessarily tied directly to the questions that are about disasters or preparedness. We recently completed a CASPER methodology. But the questions were about environmental concern perception within a community in Los Angeles. One of our environmental health investigation branch teams thought that communities would be concerned about some specific environmental issues. And through using CASPER methodology, we found out communities actually interested in very different environmental issues than we had originally thought. So we were able to use that to the community leadership in this Los Angeles area to actually the community, we're slowly going about what we talked to the concern for. But the CASPER tool let us do this in that kind of so just a plug for even if you're not doing preparedness, this kind of methodology is really
Yeah, I mean, for especially for non-disaster scenario, depending on your objective, you want us to know. Yes, you can design your questionnaires and you use a cluster sampling methodology. This is just, you select first 30 clusters, and second stage, you select seven households for interviews, 30 by 7. And in general, at the end of the day, you ended up doing 210 surveys. That's the standard. We use it for different purposes, especially, I remember, Michigan, we went to do just for radiological preparedness. There is no radiological disaster, just their community was prepared for that. We use that kind of stuff. In Kentucky, coal gas gasification plants, they want us to build, but they want to assess the community perception toward that new plant. So that was their objectives. We didn't provide that kind of information. So there are different ways. But the message from our side is define your objective. When you define objective, define your resource. Do you have resources and everything? You want us to do a census? You want us to do everything, interview in the community? Go for it. You have money and the time. Otherwise, if you don't have, CASPER methodology is very useful. Select the 30 clusters, do 7 interview. You are there to get any scientific sound data.
Dan, don't leave yet. This is for you still. You're on the hot seat.
I'm from the California Department of Public Health, but I'm aware that the city of Berkeley has sort of proactively done all the selection, the two-stage sampling, just in case, and you know, filed it away in a drawer somewhere so that if an emergency comes up, they can pull it out and hit the ground running. So I don't know if that's something that could be promoted in other areas. And Berkeley is a fairly small, you know, confined sort of square little town. It might be easier to do it in things like that. And I thought that was pretty innovative on their part. So they're all ready to go with the selection. And they don't have to start from scratch.
Yeah, I mean, there are some thoughts on that regarding on that, especially for non-disaster situation, it may apply. But for during disaster, we don't know, is that area hit or not? Are we going to assess, is it part of your assessment, that area or not? We don't know. In disaster, following a disaster, the first thing you need to do is define your assessment area. How you define your assessment area? It may be aerial view with FEMA, with helicopters, or you send the peoples. They assess the affected area. Once you identify and define, this is my assessment area, from that affected area, you select cluster probe. Maybe it's part of the county, it is not the whole county. But if you pre-designate your clusters from the whole county, after a fact, my night may not be applied. For non-disaster, it is work. I know WHO are talking about, especially second stage, pre-selecting the 7 houses. That is a new version 2015 coming out of the EPI. There under discussion. I agree the first two because our two already were ahead of things. One is to give proportional equal chance for each household. The second is to use a tracking form to track all the interview. We have it in our tool. They are updating their tools. They are late. We did in 2012. But the third recommendation is to select the 7 houses ahead of time and do the interview in that place. I disagree on that because for non-disaster you may apply, but during disaster, following a disaster, maybe there is no house over there. So consider the environment. Talk to the locals. The locals, they know where to go.
Thank you. One more question, then I'm going to invite the speakers all to come up and we'll have a general discussion.
Yeah, you're letting me alone.
I know.
I'm Laura Cameron from Michigan. So I was wondering, does CDC provide any support in a situation where you can't really do residence-based samples? So I can take an example of a project I worked on one time. I was looking at migrant workers, and they didn't live in a migrant housing project. They were sort of scattered around. Is there any sort of statistical support provided through your group for deriving another sort of a roster or a sampling frame and then drawing a sample besides something that's based on where you live?
I can say short answer no, because our sampling is based on the census. We depend on the census data.
And it's household.
It is household,
right.
Yes.
So, but you can have a disaster where you can't do a
So is it a shelter?
Well, in the situation of the migrant workers, they were not the central location. So we tried to find rosters that would be serviced by Provenzano and their sampling frame.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have that kind of suppository, data. We don't host that data in our system.
So I think one of the differences, because your situation was different, is that it's a fluid population as opposed to an established. I think the rapid needs assessment, yeah.
They're not defined by the residents, they're defined by their job.
Right, so that's, in a certain sense, might be a different tool that you would need to use to apply, that it might not be able to fit well with the CASPER, exactly. So, interesting issue. What I'd like to do really quickly is to invite our speakers to all three come up and have a seat here. And as they're coming up, I want to cast a little bit of perspective here. In case you didn't already know it, CSTE has a very active disaster epidemiology subcommittee, and the subcommittee has a variety of working groups. And actually, I want to announce and invite you, in case there's people here who want a 10-hour working day, to please join us this afternoon for our disaster epidemiology roundtable, which will be from 5:45 to 6:30 in the Beacon Room F. So Beacon Room is in the Sheraton Hotel, so you have to go through those doors in the same building where we did the plenaries this morning. But I want to invite you to come to that if you'd like to know more about what it is that we're doing, what it is we have been doing, and what it is that we'd like to be doing, and what it is you want us to do. It's an opportunity for that exchange. And by way of perspective, if you haven't already gotten it, this design of this session this morning was to really focus on three aspects of applying epidemiologic skills and tools in disaster response. Certainly, so we had first the shelter surveillance with Miguel, and then worker health and safety focus with Renee, and then with TESFAE, the community focused rapid needs assessment. So three different aspects, and now I want to open it up to all of you for more comments, more questions that you want to direct to any or all of the speakers. Take it away. And you can either just talk or use this if it's needed. And please, again, say your name and where you're from.
Peter Garrison from the Kansas Department of Health and Environment. This question is for Dr. Cruz. In our state, the Red Cross is primarily responsible for mass sheltering and care, ESF6. Have you worked at the Red Cross, and do they conduct these environmental shelter assessments?
Yes, my understanding is that the Red Cross has their own assessment tool that they're trying to implement. We have taken a look at that too, because we do a lot of work with Red Cross Disaster Services with the Washington Group. And they, however, there is an absence of public health variables in that assessment too. So we are working, we're having discussions about to kind of add variables of interest to us, because there are two big national shelter systems that collect data or information about the specific shelter facilities. However, again, they don't have a lot of variables of public health interest. So there's an area that we can go there to maybe expand a little bit.
And then ESF 13 and Tampa Department of Agriculture, that would be agricultural and animal related issues, but they also, that's where our food inspection program and lodging inspection program is, and public health is the same. So, and this is giving me some ideas to kind of help us partner with that. And although we may have limited resources to conduct food inspection, we'll reach out to our National Guard partners and work with them a little more closely on that. So, I'll also just throw that out there for other states to consider as well.
Yes, I think that when we talk about disasters, we're always thinking ESFA, which is Public Health America. But we forgot that it's a six, it's shelter. So who is in shelter? You know, people saying shelters are our most vulnerable people. It's the responsibility of the public health agency to kind of keep an eye on what's going on in shelters, because if something can start, it can potentially start there. So we need to work closely with ESF6 partners. Because the goal of everybody, whether you are ESF-A or ESF-6, is to protect people, and we can do that better if we're working together.
So you brought up actually a very good point, and then I'll get to the next question, and that is there's more of the ESF numbers that public health is necessarily assigned as a primary where we have jurisdiction. And I think it's really flexible, but public health in many, many states is starting to step up and taking more of a partnership role and joining with others as opposed to stepping back. So thank you for bringing that up. Did you have a question or comment? We'll go here and then here.
Ashley Foley from New Hampshire. I work at the local health department. And to build on your comment, every state is a little different. In New Hampshire, we are actually training the local health officers in each town to try and take over the role of doing the health environmental assessments so that they're at the local level. They work with those facilities already in the preparedness phase, which can they build that into protocols. We're trying to work with the local emergency management directors and those environmental health specialists and health officers to integrate it into their plans ahead of time. Because in our state, the state may not have, probably doesn't have the capacity to go out to all the shelters if we were to have a large-scale disaster. So we're trying to build it at that local level, and then also working with our medical reserve corps volunteers to assist with some of this, because we won't have enough state staff to come out.
Yes, I think it's very important to build capacity at the local level, but also we need to look at how we're going to work in large-scale disasters. And we have 3 or 4 states that are affected, and we have only a team of 50 sanitarians available from different states. So we need to have consistency, and we need to have standardized methods so that we can look at the data across states or regions, even regions, and say, okay, this is where we need to send our resources. We need the data to drive those resources because we don't have that many resources available during emergencies. So it's important to build capacity at the local level, but always keep in the back of your mind that in a large disaster, we're going to need to make quick decisions. And the better organized we are with the testing, I think the better that we're going to be able to move forward with the actions to protect people.
Please, and then we'll go back.
My name is Albertina from Hawaii Department of Health. I have a question. Probably everybody. During the disaster, so after the disaster, is there any protocol to management of the infectious diseases? Because we always have a lot of infectious diseases, diarrhea, parasites, or any kind of thing. So is there any protocol for that, for the infectious diseases after the disaster?
I can't speak for infectious disease department for CDC, but if the locals really think they have a risk or some vulnerable situation down there following the disaster for any disease outbreak, the state health department can directly contact the CDC, and the CDC, according to which office has to respond, they know specifically the subject matter experts and the channel the message. And there is, I don't know if you are familiar with the mechanism. That kind of read out, you can call it an APA, then CDC designated in the
I would think that pretty much all of these tools could be used in an infectious disease situation. Like I said, ERMS was used extensively in the Ebola outbreak. You know, and I really encourage, even though we kind of gear it towards emergency responders in disasters, to try to use some of these principles all the time. So anytime you're sending out a public health team to do a TB investigation or a foodborne outbreak or something, you know, think about using some of these tools. That way it won't be quite so foreign to you, you know, when it comes time to use them in a disaster. I know we have something in the ERMS tools called the Welcome Home Letter, and it's for people who, you know, I've heard that some states have started using it for like TB outbreaks. And so if they deploy people from different counties to all go and help with a big TB outbreak, so when they send them home, they send go home with the Welcome Home Letter, and you know, it says like, I was working on a TB outbreak, and if you get sick, tell your physician, you know, that you were involved with this, and you know, give them some information to give to their physician back at home if they become sick. So there's a lot of materials like that that are in there that you can use just on a daily basis besides during the disaster.
Well, I just want to add that I think it's an important in the preliminary phase of planning for any big emergency, or if you get hit by a big emergency, is to talk to your partners about how you can implement the communicable disease surveillance. We have tools available that are widely used during emergencies, so you know, rapid implementation of the community-based surveillance, and then in terms of shelters, we have tools that can be used in shelters. We have tools that can be quickly deployed with minimal assistance from main organizations. But the important thing is to move forward. It's better just to have a system in place just in case, and to not have a system they have, you know, you start having issues in shelters. In some disasters, they quickly leave, you know, they just come and go. But the day that we have a big disaster like a Katrina, like again, we're going to need good systems, and the best way to do that is to work together, because we know the local, and sometimes the state don't have enough resources, so raise the alarm and call for help. It's the best thing that you can do in the early phase of an emergency.
The gentleman right behind you, and then hold on, what's that right behind you? Go ahead. Yes.
Hi, I'm Norman Anderson. I'm an environmental public health consultant from Maine. Thank you all. Great presentation. My question relates more towards the mental health assessment, certainly with the first responders, but maybe with the community as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And it's based on some studies that I read a while back where first responders that were aware that human-induced climate change was a factor, in the, at least a contributing factor in the disasters, had a harder time in terms of their recovery and in terms of the mental health aspects. I was wondering if that's being considered in your assessment of the workers.
I haven't heard about that actually, but it's interesting. I would love to know more. If there's a way you could send me that paper or something, I would appreciate that. We are, you know, as I said, we're really trying to include mental health with everything. And I mean, one thing to remember is that, you know, it's natural to have some sort of response. It doesn't necessarily, you know, some sort of stress reaction or whatever after a disaster. Not necessarily pathological, and it's not necessarily mental illness, but that's where it's just good to keep in touch with people and keep, you know, make sure they get help immediately, and then a lot of times that can, you know, they can recover and go back to a normal state. And I think sometimes people get, caught up in, you know, I don't know, when I was a sincere, you know, people are like, oh my gosh, she has PTSD. It's like, well, she's kind of freaking out. That's okay. Like, it's not necessarily PTSD. Like, you know what I mean? So, anyway. Yeah. No, I'm just kind of philosophizing. But, so anyway, I'm just saying it's I'd be interested to see sort of where they put that in as far as the stress reaction versus, you know, more of a pathological response. I was trying to tie it in.
From our side, from the community side, we always want to respond for a disaster. We still consider the mental health of the community, the mental health of the community. So we look for our, one of the challenges, the baseline data. Is there a baseline data with the community before a disaster? When is the start of that? So that's a little bit hard from our side. We can go and ask some questions, but it's comparable. Is it a normal? If it is a normal, I can say that. That's one of the area really is facing the problem. But we did an oil spill in Alabama that made our questions were focused on assessing the mental health of the community. So we tried to compare with BR data, and they were literally high comparing from the system. Then the state started to implement. So now they are monitoring yearly, the same methodology using, but yearly for 5 years, that's the plan. And then try to figure whether it is an improvement. But it's very important part for us, mental health.
Did you want to add to that?
Yeah, just quickly, we just, with regards to shelters. shelters have a very environment. People there, sometimes they don't know the status of their homes, they don't know the status of their families, and you are in very crowded conditions with a bunch of people that probably don't know. So, you know, we need to be aware of those issues. And they have been, there's good documentation from health needs assessments conducted in shelters that indicate high levels of stress.
So the article is interesting. I think many people would be interested in it. You can get it to Renee. I'll give you my card when we're done, and if people are interested, you can get a hold of me. You know, I'm on the whatever the you can get a hold of me, and I can get it to you. I assume you had a question, and I think that'll need to be close to our last, so I can let you go and have lunch.
You know, an application of assessment for special events. While remember that we do have partners, for example, during the disaster, what the community will be doing, the immunization program will be doing, the doctors will be doing. We will not be alone in this situation. Just our role is to implement the CASPER before, during, or after the disaster as soon as possible.
So we're right at noon, and I don't want to stop you from your lunch, but I want to thank you all for attending, and please join me in thanking our speakers for a great presentation. And you're all invited to come to the Disaster EPI Roundtable this afternoon.